This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Hugh Akers,
Jane Bolton,
John Ward,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Hugh, your family has had a long involvement with the A&P show.
Yes, I suppose it started with about 1886 when the Manawatu A&P, or Manawatu West Coast A&P, was first formed. And my great grandfather William Akers was on the foundation committee when it was first formed. So ever since then, there's been one of the Akers family on the committee right up until possibly 8 or 10 years ago. My younger sister finished up being on the committee. Mm. So there's always been one of us there. So it goes back a long time.
Okay, so do you know anything about the early days of the show? What was involved?
Not a great deal other than the information's there, because there was a book put out after the centenary of the show, that what we call the Blue Book, and there's full of history in that. Mm. And some of the earlier photographs are pretty interesting in showing the progress of the showgrounds and the buildings going up and the halls being used during the First and Second Wars. Mm. The exhibition halls were, and by the Army. So, but right from the first Royal Show in 1940s, I think, 46. My grandfather, Hugh Akers, was president at that time when the first Royal Show was formed, which was first held in Palmerston North.
So what made it a Royal Show?
The Royal Show, when the Royal Ag Society started up, and we had the first Royal Show in Palmerston North in the 1940s.
They moved around, didn't they, from city to city? It didn't just stay in Palmerston.
Well, since then, yes. Every each year's move used to be around five A&P associations in the country. Five? Mm. There might have been four, I think, yes.
So it was set up as a local A&P society for local farmers and marketing of machinery and selling stock and so on. What was that?
Yeah, it was mainly for showing stock. Mm. But in those days, when it first started, the rail yards were used for bringing stock to Palmerston Railway Station, and then walked to the showgrounds.
Okay.
But, a lot of sheep and cattle came by train in those days, when they first started. So they were holding paddocks and that thing for a lot of the livestock.
So it was an annual event that was a major marketing exercise. When if people wanted new stock, they would wait for that show and go?
How the breeders were going with their stud stock. Mm. I think there wasn't much in the way of stud stock in those early days. I think probably early 1900s before they had you had stud stock. But it was an exhibition, and in those days, even in the earlier days, the exhibition halls, they held winter shows as well.
Okay.
Produce?
Yes, the winter show was held in the exhibition halls that were later burnt down, but they had sheep carcasses and pig carcasses.
So no actual livestock.
And there's a competition.
Yeah.
There wasn't a livestock. It was was produce in the winter show, in the exhibition halls, meat competitions, meat carcass, different livestock. Yeah. So it was very, very interesting, and there are a lot of good photographs of those exhibitions. Yeah.
So it's a major thing that all the farmers would try to get to.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was for the city people as well.
The city people were very much involved in running it because all the hotels would be full, you know, during the show period, because the farmers had travelled big distances to get there, and of course in those days, a lot of them came by horse and cart and stayed at the hotels, so it was pretty full on for the city in those days, when it was still quite small. So it's probably in more recent years, of course, the Manawatu show did move from the city to Fielding, to Manfield Park. But in the meantime, our family had been involved through to my father. Like my grandfather, Hugh, was president, and then my father, Alan Akers, was president, and then I became president. So we've all had our turn, so been a part of it.
There was a lot of judging going on with the animals.
The judging of animals, yes. Well, that was pretty serious business.
Acres were involved with
yes, the judging. Yes, my father and grandfather, all judging. I used to help my father quite a bit. I had done a little bit myself, but usually I used to assist my father judging Perendals and Cheviots. And before that, my father had been judging Romneys and what have you. But my father had always been originally a cattle steward, and then he went to the sheep section and was chief steward for a very long time from that. And then we had Dave Kilgar followed him, and then I followed Dave Kilgar. And so I was chief steward in the sheep section for quite a long time.
So what do you look for in judging, and has that changed much over time?
It's what you're looking for is true to type and conformation of the sheep, soundness. But a lot of it's it was more on appearance and looks. In those early days, you didn't have figures about the genetics or anything like that. It was more the appearance, and true to type was very important. And being sound, good feet.
And the wool? Did you judge the wool?
And the inner quality wool, yes. Particularly in the wool breeds. With the meat breeds, it was more confirmation, the fat levels and with the old South Downs and that sort of thing. And the meat breeds, it was quite a bit different. The wool breeds, wool was very much, the quality had to be right, soundness of the wool.
Has that changed much? I know the confirmation sometimes changed, but not about, has the wool quality changed over the years?
Well, the Perendale breed did actually allow the wool to get a bit stronger, which was a bit disappointed at the time. But, it really hasn't changed a great deal, and of course wool sort of hasn't been such a high priority in recent years in the farmer's view, but to me, I've always maintained trying to keep the wool fine and good staple and true to type for Perendale wool, because you can always sell good wool, whereas if you let your wool go back to get this high lustrous type wool, there's a very limited market for it. So we found by keeping the quality and the fineness, the finer it was, the more you got, more money you were paid.
It was lighter, wasn't it? The Perendale wool was much lighter than the Romley.
A bit lighter because it was finer.
Now you're saying about the different qualities of wool, but that affects the use. And now there's a lot of synthetics and even plant-based material. So is that having a big impact on the type of wool that's being grown or the market for?
Well, I mean, your finer wool is course, they've always paid a lot more, haven't they? Mm. And your strong wall's got limitations.
Carpets.
Carpet.
Mm.
And for instance, the carpet companies, when they were producing, woolen carpets in a big way, they always wanted some of our high bulk Perendal wool. They needed something like 12% of high bulk wool to go with your Romney type, lustrous type wool to give that spring, so the wool springs back up.
Yeah.
Yeah, they need that high bulk wool. And so I've always tried to produce high bulk wool because I had no problem selling it.
Mm. Yeah,
and I was always told by the economic service, Beef and Lamb Economic Service, they couldn't understand why our price for our Perendal wool, our wool was always higher than anyone else's when they were doing their research.
You mean your Perendal compared to other Perendal, or Perendal compared to other?
Yeah, our Perendal
Perendal
would be higher bulk than most, isn't it? And that comes out from the Cheviot.
Yeah.
That gives them the higher bulk. And so I always tried to keep it that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was always important to, for me, because I got that premium price. Yeah.
Does the farming environment affect the nature of the sheep's wool? So I say if you have sheep on the flat rather than in the hill country, or, so the different weather environment and maybe the feed?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's like with wool, the better feed you give them, the stronger the wool will be. If you have them up in the hills on brown top and not a great deal to eat, they'll always be a bit finer, but your fleece will be lighter too. But it'll be finer, and there's always a greater chance there might be a break in the wool too. If they get a tough period. So
finer is better if it's strong enough. You mean, or because?
Finer is better for price wise. Yeah. I mean, that's why your merinos are on.
Yeah. Okay.
They're on eating weeds, or they're not on flash pasture, and that keeps their wool finer as well.
So
the merinos don't do any good on lower flat wet countries. So.
Okay.
So what's the bulk like in a merino? They have massive bulk, don't they?
It's generally fairly good bulk too, but there are like Pole Dorset has high bulk wool too, a bit like your Cheviot. When you get a handful, you know you've got a handful, whereas a lot of your lustrous type wool, you grab it and it just there's nothing there. And that's what keeps your carpet sprung up a bit, is that high bulk. Now that these carpet companies are going back into wool, like Cavalier going to do all wool again instead of synthetics.
Right.
Well, it's got to be good.
So there's a pickup in demand for wool now.
It's not showing much, but it will do, I think.
Yeah.
And how much they'll take, but our type of wool's ideal for them. There will be a big improvement. But we used to supply Feltex, their carpets, when they were operating. And they were buying our wool every year because of the high bulk that they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So hopefully with Cavalier getting into wool, it's got to be good.
So what's the attitude of sheep? I mean, you've gone through, you would have, in when you were very young, it was the real boom time for wool. And since then, since the 1980s, it's been much lower, hasn't it? So what's the attitude of sheep farmers to that?
Well, in those days, we relied on wool. It was our biggest single income check. And after shearing costs, we still made a good profit out of it. But as the price has gone down, in the last 10 years haven't been that flash, people are looking at other ways of saving costs because it's now become, for our type of wool, cost to shear them when, and you're losing money.
Yeah.
So that's why farmers are looking at other breeds of sheep.
Yeah.
Because of that, I would hope that wool will come back again. I still believe so, and it's therefore important that when my son's buying rams, that he's still looking at the wool.
Yeah.
Because a lot of farmers won't do that. They're just looking at the genetics only. Yeah.
Mm. Breeding wool for meat than wool.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because if you lose your wool, it takes years to pick it up again, to breed it back up again.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go to that trouble of building it up, you might as well keep it. It costs you no more to buy it.
Well, was the move though also to twins rather than single lambs?
Yeah, this is all genetics, multiple.
Yeah.
You know, more lambs, and that's where the money is, I suppose. Yeah. And
that's so that's because of the meat they're choosing.
Yeah, because that's where the income is.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And what they're trying to do now, because they're going to the likes of Wiltshire breeds and Dorpers, they're looking at cutting out the shearing costs.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening.
They're getting
the nut lambs on the ground, and that's what their income is.
Oh, just not bother with the shearing? Or there was talk, the sheep that just shed there.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
That's the Dorper, isn't it?
Okay. The Dorper and your Wiltshire.
So does that mean they just lose the wool and forget about it? Or?
That's right, falls on the ground.
Okay.
The birds use it for nesting.
For nesting, okay.
Brilliant, yeah.
That seems to be a general trend at the moment. But it'd only take, the wool to pick up again.
Yeah.
And then those people will be missing out.
Yeah.
They'll be getting their lamb money, the money from lambs, the income from lambs.
Yeah.
They'll miss out on the income from wool.
But what's to say if you want to change from one to the other? You're looking at, what, 3 or 4 years?
Probably a bit longer even.
Yeah.
Yeah, to do it properly.
Yeah. Yeah,
five or six years, I would say.
Yeah.
And
you've lost the stock quality at the same time.
Well, it's not the stock quality, it's just the wool.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, these other breeds that shed their wool still produce, good lambs.
Yeah.
And a lot of them too. So that's where the money is at the time. It's just a trendy thing.
Yeah.
So what breed is it that you can get 2 lambs a year?
If you can get two lambs a year. Well,
no, I mean two lambing seasons. They'll have not just twins once,
a lamb twice a year.
Yes.
Yes.
What's that breed?
I don't know if they can do it, but it's probably three lambings from 2 years or something.
Yeah.
I know the prices for cull ewes are sky high, and there's been big money for that. So there's still money in sheep, and I think if you're doing the sheep job right, you can still make damn near as much money as dairying anyway. So
okay. Mm. Well, you went through all the reforms in the 80s and the removal of subsidies and so on.
Yes.
How did that lead you to have to make major changes?
I think it was a shock at the time, and how to deal with it. At least I wasn't owing too much money that it was going to hurt too much. You just basically had to pull your horns in and just do the basics right, and you probably slowed up in spending.
Yeah.
Things just slowed up.
Can you remember what the interest rates were when the subsidies came off? Interest rates on borrowed money?
Yes.
Because it was high.
You would probably remember that more, Joan.
They got up towards 20% sometimes.
It was very high. Yeah.
But with high inflation at the same time.
I think it was 21%, I think, was the highest we were paying.
Yeah. Mm. It really, I think probably for us at the time, and we're talking about Rogernomics, at the time was a shock to farmers, and I don't think the farmers would have been quite so worried if they did it across the board and did it to the townspeople at the same time. Mm. But when they isolated farmers first, and then gradually got into, you know, years, one or two years later. In the meantime, the damage had been done. Yeah. The towns, the small towns, were falling apart.
Yeah, yeah.
There were empty cottages. Were, you know, farmers couldn't afford staff anymore.
Yeah, and it would have things like that. It hit
the rural towns
as well.
And the small villages really, really badly.
Yes,
and yet we could see nothing, nothing being pinned on the people in the city.
Yeah.
And that's what probably hurt us the most.
Yeah.
Did it lead to farm amalgamations then? Because some people would have had to sell, wouldn't they?
No. Well, farmers couldn't buy much.
Oh, they didn't have the money to.
No.
So who was buying? The Queen Street farmers?
Yeah, well, that's about all that people could afford to.
Mm. Yeah.
There wasn't much of it.
Mm.
And staff, we shared it. It just broke the small towns.
Yeah. There was talk about sort of almost corporatisation of farming and maybe dairying and so on, but has the same happened in sheep, or is it more the family sheep farm type of structure?
There's been a bit of both. A bit of both. There's been town people buying, you know, property, and putting managers on, that sort of thing. There's been a bit of that over the years, quite a bit of that, really.
But for all taking the subsidies off, we did survive.
Yes.
And it had its good points.
Yeah.
But when I think of the overseas farmers being subsidised now, still, I'm thinking, about time that you stood on your own 2 feet.
Well, there is a counter to that, because someone in, you know, was in France and saying, oh, we don't have subsidies in New Zealand. And he said, well, except you've got, well, there's the schooling, the health, there's the fertiliser subsidies, there's a provision of internet and so on, there's cross-subsidisation to rural areas through some of that.
I don't know about that.
Well, no, the provision of education and,
for everybody.
And so on. So, yes,
for everybody, yes.
So where facilities are provided, it's probably cheaper than the actual costs in some of those areas.
And I think overseas, they kept the subsidies going for the smaller farmers to keep them on their farms instead of sending them
some
to cities.
Some were paying not to, in Europe, to maintain the farms as farmland and not to produce.
And not to go to the cities to find, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, almost doing that here too. wanting us to cut the cow numbers back, the dairy cows.
Ah, yeah. Well, they say it can be more profitable if you have lower stock, though, don't they?
Providing you feed them.
Well, I don't know how they can keep going, you know, upping the performance of each cow. Unless
so is
they,
it lowering,
unless
the,
start,
lowering the costs as well, though?
Unless they start giving them dope of some sort, you know.
Yeah.
Start pouring chemicals into them or something. What else can they do? Because they're producing pretty well now.
Yeah.
Genetically modified grass. Genetically engineered grass has been suggested.
Yeah. So your view then, your farming has really been your life, your family tradition and so on. Are you optimistic now compared to in the past? Or?
I think you've got to be. No
you
point.
Have to be or there's reason to be?
Well, I think you just got to keep a positive outlook, otherwise you'll lose yourself.
Yeah, and you think farmers farm for the lifestyle, the quality of life.
It's a lifestyle, and it's a way of living. You've got to work hard for it.
Yeah.
If you don't, you'll lose it.
Yeah.
But that's the enjoyment of it. It is that you know you've got so many different jobs to do. You've got to be an electrician, a plumber, you name it. You've got to be a vet. You've got to know a bit of everything. You've got to have a you know, be very practical.
You've got to be a business person.
You're not a business person, you'll lose it as well. So you've got to be
multitasker
to do everything.
And it's still
otherwise you're going to have to call on help. Yeah. You know, someone that is. If you're missing, if you're missing one of those pieces, you've got to get someone to do it for you, or to, you know, to replace that knowledge. And otherwise, you know, there's nothing like. And I think it is good that you know, as young farmers do a university period with that, where they get the latest knowledge.
Do you find it's appealing to young people then? Is you comfortable that there will be another generation coming in to keep up farming?
I think it over to whoever's training the young ones is to encourage them, get them involved in the farm and seeing the outcome that's desirable, and they can if they can enjoy that as well as a farm worker or a young a son of a farmer coming on.
So
it's got to be made. Okay. And you know, they've got to be encouraged to do it.
And there are pathways in. I mean, you can be, if you you've got, there's a farm in the family, you can take it over. But for other people saying, I want to go into farming, they have.
Yeah, well, I think it's over to the farmers themselves to encourage them.
Yeah.
What about the salaries? Are farm workers paid the same as they would get in town, in the cities?
Yeah, I would say they have to. Otherwise, they've got to pay well. Otherwise, they will disappear.
And working conditions as well.
Yes.
But you can't say you can start at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock on Monday morning and finish at 5 on Friday, because you have to work Saturdays and Sundays as well. So how do you overcome that?
I think it's the way you go about it. And I've got a staff member here who's been over, I think it's nearly 45 years with me. He's basically the stock manager, and he's gradually built up his own equity. He's bought farmland, sold some, and then bought more, and owns one or two houses around the village. Mm-hmm. And by giving them those opportunities, it does work.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.